No pills, no chemotherapy. 97 years are enough. As for you, Lucia, I refuse to allow you to spend the next 6 months bringing me meals and pills and the bedpan. You have a family, and I can afford round-the-clock care.
You're not going to live the end of your life among strangers, Lucy said, speaking in her she-who-must-be-obeyed voice. It was the one both Abra and her father knew not to argue with. Not even Concetta could do that.
There was no discussion about Abra staying. On September 9th, she was scheduled to start the 8th grade at Anniston Middle School. It was David Stone's sabbatical year, which he was using to write a book comparing the Roaring Twenties to the Go-Go Sixties, and so, like a good many of the girls with whom she'd gone to Camp Tap, Abra shuttled from one parent to the other. During the week, she was with her father. On the weekends, she shipped down to Boston to be with her mom and Momo. She thought that things could not get worse, but they always can, and often do.
4.
Although he was working at home now, David Stone never bothered to walk down the driveway and get the mail. He claimed the U.S. Postal Service was a self-perpetuating bureaucracy that had ceased to have any relevance around the turn of the century. Every now and then a package turned up, sometimes books he'd ordered to help with his work, more often something Lucy had ordered from a catalog, but otherwise he claimed it was all junkola. When Lucy was home, she retrieved the post from the mailbox by the gate and looked the stuff over while she had her mid-morning coffee. It was mostly crap, and it went directly into what Dave called the circular file. But she wasn't home that early September, so it was Abra, now the nominal woman of the house, who checked the box when she got off the school bus. She also washed the dishes, did a load of laundry for herself and her dad twice a week, and set the Roomba Robovac going, if she remembered. She did these chores without complaint, because she knew that her mother was helping Momo and that her father's book was very important. He said this one was popular instead of academic. If it was successful, he might be able to stop teaching and write full-time, at least for a while. On this day, the 17th of September, the mailbox contained a Walmart circular, a postcard announcing the opening of a new dental office in town, "We guarantee miles of smiles," and two glossy come-ons from local realtors selling timeshares at the Mount Thunder Ski Resort. There was also a local bulk mail rag called the Anniston Shopper. This had a few wire service stories on the front two pages, and a few local stories, heavy on regional sports, in the middle. The rest was ads and coupons. If she had been home, Lucy would have saved a few of these latter and then tossed the rest of the shopper into the recycling bin. Her daughter would never have seen it. On this day, with Lucy away in Boston, Abra did. She thumbed through it as she idled her way up the driveway, then turned it over. On the back page, there were 40 or 50 photographs, not much bigger than postage stamps, most in color, a few in black and white. Above them was this heading, "Have you seen me? A weekly service of your Anniston shopper." For a moment, Abra thought it was some sort of contest, like a scavenger hunt. Then she realized these were missing children, and it was as if a hand had grasped the soft lining of her stomach and squeezed it like a washcloth. She had bought a 3-pack of Oreos in the cafe at lunch and had saved them for the bus ride home. Now she seemed to feel them being wadded up toward her throat by that clutching hand. "Don't look at it if it bothers you," she told herself. It was the stern and lecturely voice she often employed when she was upset or confused, a Momo voice, although she had never consciously realized this. "Just toss it in the garage trash can with the rest of this gluck." Only she seemed unable not to look at it. Here was Cynthia Abelard, DOB, June 9, 2005. After a moment's thought, Abra realized DOB stood for date of birth. So Cynthia would be 8 now, if she was still alive, that is. She had been missing since 2009.
How does somebody lose track of a 4-year-old? Abra wondered. She must have really crappy parents.
But of course the parents probably hadn't lost her. Probably some weirdo had been cruising around the neighborhood, seen his chance, and stolen her.
Here was Merton Askew, D.O.B. September 4, 1998. He had disappeared in 2010.
Here, halfway down the page, was a beautiful little Hispanic girl named Angel Barbera, who had disappeared from her Kansas City home at the age of 7 and had already been gone for 9 years.
Abra wondered if her parents really thought this tiny picture would help them get her back. And if they did, would they still even know her? For that matter, would she know them?
Get rid of that thing, the Momo voice said. You've got enough to worry about without looking at a lot of missing kids.
Her eyes found a picture in the very bottom row, and a little sound escaped her. Probably it was a moan. At first she didn't even know why, although she almost did. It was like how you sometimes knew the word you wanted to use in an English composition, but you still couldn't quite get it. The damn thing just sat there on the tip of your tongue. This photo was of a white kid with short hair and a great big goofy-ass grin. It looked like he had freckles on his cheeks. The picture was too small to tell for sure, but they're freckles. You know they are.
Abra was somehow sure, anyway.
Yes, they were freckles, and his big brothers had teased him about them, and his mother told him they would go away in time.
She told him freckles are good luck, Abra whispered.
Bradley Trevor, D.O.B., March 2, 2000. Missing since July 12, 2011. Race, Caucasian. Location, Bankerton, Iowa. Current age, 13. And below this, below all these pictures of mostly smiling children, if you think you have seen Bradley Trevor, contact the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. Only no one was going to contact him about Bradley, because no one was going to see him. His current age wasn't 13 either. Bradley Trevor had stopped at 11. He had stopped like a busted wristwatch that shows the same time 24 hours a day. Abra found herself wondering if freckles faded underground.
The baseball boy, she whispered.
There were flowers lining the driveway. Abra leaned over, hands on her knees, pack all at once far too heavy on her back, and threw up her Oreos and the undigested portion of her school lunch into her mother's asters. When she was sure she wasn't going to puke a second time, she went into the garage and tossed the mail into the trash. All the mail. Her father was right. It was junk cola.
5.
The door of the little room her dad used as his study was open, and when Abra stopped at the kitchen sink for a glass of water to rinse the sour chocolate taste of used Oreos out of her mouth, she heard the keyboard of his computer clicking steadily away. That was good. When it slowed down or stopped completely, he had a tendency to be grumpy. Also, he was more apt to notice her. Today, she didn't want to be noticed.
"Abadoo, is that you?"
her father half sang. Ordinarily, she would have asked him to please stop using that baby name, but not today.
"Yep, it's me. School go okay?"
The steady click, click, click had stopped.
"Please don't come out here," Abra prayed. "Don't come out and look at me and ask me why I'm so pale or something."
"Fine. How's the book?" "Having a great day," he said. "Writing about the Charleston and the Black Bottom. Vododiodo."
Whatever that meant. The important thing was the click, click, click started up again. Thank God.
"Terrific," she said, rinsing her glass and putting it in the drainer.
"I'm going upstairs to start my homework."
"That's my girl. Think Harvard and 18. Okay, Dad.
And maybe she would. Anything to keep herself from thinking about Bankerton, Iowa, in 11.
6.
Only she couldn't stop. Because what? Because why? Because, well, because there are things I can do. She IM'd with Jessica for a while,
but then Jessica went to the mall in North Conway to have dinner at Panda Garden with her parents, so Abra opened her social studies book. She meant to go to Chapter 4, a majorly boresome 20 pages titled How Our Government Works, but instead the book had fallen open to Chapter 5, Your Responsibilities as a Citizen.
Oh, God. If there was a word she didn't want to see this afternoon, it was responsibilities. She went into the bathroom for another glass of water because her mouth still tasted bleak and found herself staring at her own freckles in the mirror. There were exactly 3, one on her left cheek and 2 on her schnoz. Not bad. She had lucked out in the freckles department. Nor did she have a birthmark like Bethany Stevens, or a cocked eye like Norman McGinley, or a stutter like Jenny Whitlaw, or a horrible name like poor picked-on Pence Eversham. Abra was a little strange, of course, but Abra was fine. People thought it was interesting instead of just weird, like Pence, who was known among the boys, but girls always somehow found these things out, as Pence the Penis. And the biggie. I didn't get cut apart by crazy people who paid no attention when I screamed and begged them to stop. I didn't have to see some of the crazy people licking my blood off the palms of their hands before I died. Abadou is one lucky ducky. But maybe not such a lucky ducky after all. Lucky duckies didn't know things they had no business knowing. She closed the lid of the toilet, sat on it, and cried quietly with her hands over her face. Being forced to think of Bradley Trevor again, and how he died was bad enough. But it wasn't just him. There were all those other kids to think about. So many pictures that they were crammed together on the last page of the shopper like the school assembly from hell. All those gap-toothed smiles, and all those eyes that knew even less of the world than Abra did herself. And what did she know? Not even how our government works. What did the parents of those missing children think? How did they go on with their lives? Was Cynthia or Merton or Angel the first thing they thought about in the morning and the last thing they thought about at night? Did they keep their rooms ready for them in case they came home? Or did they give all their clothes and toys away to the Goodwill? Abra had heard that was what Lenny O'Meara's parents did after Lenny fell out of a tree and hit his head on a rock and died. Lenny O'Meara, who got as far as the 5th grade and then just stopped. But of course Lenny's parents knew he was dead. There was a grave where they could go and put flowers, and maybe that made it different. Maybe not. But Abra thought it would, because otherwise you'd pretty much have to wonder, wouldn't you? Like when you were eating breakfast, you'd wonder if you're missing Cynthia, Merton, Angel. Was also eating breakfast somewhere, or flying a kite, or picking oranges with a bunch of migrants, or whatever. In the back of your mind, you'd have to be pretty sure he or she was dead. That's what happened to most of them. You only had to watch Action News at 6 to know, but you couldn't be sure. There was nothing she could do about that uncertainty for the parents of Cynthia Abelard, or Merton Askew, or Angel Barbera. She had no idea what had happened to them. But that wasn't true of Bradley Trevor. She had almost forgotten him. Then that stupid newspaper. Those stupid pictures. And the stuff that had come back to her. Stuff she didn't even know she knew. As if the pictures had been startled out of her subconscious. And those things she could do. Things she had never told her parents about because it would worry them. The way she guessed it would worry them if they knew she had made out with Bobby Flanagan. Just a little, no sucking face or anything gross like that, one day after school.
That was something they wouldn't want to know. Abra guessed, and about this she wasn't entirely wrong, although there was no telepathy involved, that in her parents' minds, she was sort of frozen at 8, and would probably stay that way at least until she got boobs, which she sure hadn't yet, not that she'd notice anyway. So far, they hadn't even had the talk with her. Julie Vandiver said it was almost always your mom who gave you the lowdown, but the only lowdown Abra had gotten lately was on how important it was for her to get the trash out on Thursday mornings before the bus came. "We don't ask you to do many chores," Lucy said, "and this fall it's especially important for all of us to pitch in." Momo had at least approached the talk. In the spring, she had taken Abra aside one day and said, "Do you know what boys want from girls once boys and girls get to be about your age?" "Sex, I guess," Abra had said, although all that humble, scurrying Pence Eversham ever seemed to want was one of her cookies, or to borrow a quarter for the vending machines, or to tell her how many times he'd seen the Avengers. Momo had nodded. "You can't blame human nature. It is what it is. But don't give it to them. Period. End of discussion. You can rethink things when you're 19 if you want." That had been a little embarrassing, but at least it was straight and clear. There was nothing clear about the thing in her head. That was her birthmark, invisible but real. Her parents no longer talked about the crazy shit that had happened when she was little. Maybe they thought the thing that had caused that stuff was almost gone. Sure, she'd known Momo was sick, but that wasn't the same as the crazy piano music, or turning on the water in the bathroom, or the birthday party, which she barely remembered, when she had hung spoons all over the kitchen ceiling. She had just learned to control it. Not completely, but mostly. And it had changed. Now she rarely saw things before they happened, or take moving stuff around. When she was 6 or 7, she could have concentrated on her pile of schoolbooks and lifted them all the way to the ceiling. Nothing to it. Easy as knitting kitten breeches, as Momo liked to say. Now, even if it was only a single book, she could concentrate until it felt like her brains were going to come splooshing out her ears, and she might only be able to shove it a few inches across her desk. That was on a good day. On many, she couldn't even flutter the pages. But there were other things she could do, and in many cases far better than she'd been able to as a little kid. Looking into people's heads, for instance. She couldn't do it with everyone. Some people were entirely enclosed. Others only gave off intermittent flashes. But many people were like windows with the curtains pulled back. She could look in any time she felt like it. Mostly she didn't want to, because the things she discovered were sometimes sad and often shocking. Finding out that Mrs. Moran, her beloved 6th grade teacher, was having an affair had been the biggest mind-blower so far, and not in a good way. These days, she mostly kept the seeing part of her mind shut down. Learning to do that had been difficult at first, like learning to skate backwards or print with her left hand, but she had learned. Practice didn't make perfect, not yet at least, but it sure helped. She still sometimes looked, but always tentatively, ready to pull back at the first sign of something weird or disgusting. And she never peeked into her parents' minds, or into Momo's. It would have been wrong. Probably it was wrong with everyone, but it was like Momo herself had said, "You can't blame human nature," and there was nothing more human than curiosity. Sometimes she could make people do things. Not everyone, not even half of everyone. But a lot of people were very open to suggestions. Probably they were the same ones who thought the stuff they sold on TV really would take away their wrinkles or make their hair grow back. Abra knew this was a talent that could grow if she exercised it like a muscle, but she didn't. It scared her. There were other things, too, some for which she had no name. But the one she was thinking about now did have one. She called it far-seeing. Like the other aspects of her special talent, it came and went, but if she really wanted it, and if she had an object to fix upon, she could usually summon it. "I could do that now." "Shut up, Abadoo," she said in a low, strained voice. Shut up, Abba Tutu.
She opened Early Algebra to tonight's homework page, which she had bookmarked with a sheet on which she had written the names Boyd, Steve, Cam, and Pete at least 20 times each. Collectively, they were Round Here, her favorite boy band. So hot, especially Cam. Her best friend, Emma Dean, thought so too. Those blue eyes, that careless tumble of blonde hair. Maybe I could help. His parents would be sad, but at least they'd know.
Shut up, Abatu. Shut up, Abatutu for brains.
If 5x minus 4 equals 26, what does x equal? 60 zillion, she said. Who cares? Her eyes fell on the names of the cute boys in Round Here, written in the pudgy cursive she and Emma affected. Writing looks more romantic that way, Emma had decreed. And all at once, they looked stupid and babyish and all wrong. They cut him up and licked his blood, and then they did something even worse to him. In a world where something like that could happen, mooning over a boy band seemed worse than wrong. Amber slammed her book shut, went downstairs. The click-click-click from her dad's study continued unabated, and out to the garage. She retrieved the shopper from the trash, brought it up to her room, and smoothed it flat on her desk. All those faces, but right now she cared about only one. 7. Her heart was thumping hard, hard, hard. She'd been scared before when she consciously tried to farsee or thought read, but never scared like this. Never even close.
What are you going to do if you find out?
That was a question for later, because she might not be able to. A sneaking, cowardly part of her mind hoped for that. Abra put the first two fingers of her left hand on the picture of Bradley Trevor, because her left hand was the one that saw better. She would have liked to get all her fingers on it, and if it had been an object, she would have held it, but the picture was too small. Once her fingers were on it, she couldn't even see it anymore. Except she could. She saw it very well. Blue eyes, like Cam Knowles in Round Here. You couldn't tell from the picture, but they were that same deep shade. She knew. Right-handed, like me, but left-handed like me, too. It was the left hand that knew what pitch was coming next. Fastball or curve, but... Abra gave a little gasp. The baseball boy had known things. The baseball boy really had been like her. Yes, that's right. That's why they took him. She closed her eyes and saw his face. Bradley Trevor. Brad, to his friends. The baseball boy. Sometimes he turned his cap around because that way it was a rally cap. His father was a farmer. His mother cooked pies and sold them at a local restaurant, also at the family farm stand. When his big brother went away to college, Brad took all his AC/DC discs. He and his best friend Al especially liked the song Big Balls. They'd sit on Brad's bed and sing it together and laugh and laugh. He walked through the corn, and a man was waiting for him. Brad thought he was a nice man, one of the good guys, because the man... Barry, Abra whispered in a low voice. Behind her closed lids, her eyes moved rapidly back and forth, like those of a sleeper in the grip of a vivid dream. His name was Barry the Chunk. He fooled you, Brad, didn't he? But not just Barry. If it had been just him, Brad might have known. It had to be all of the flashlight people working together, sending the same thought, that it would be okay to get into Barry the Chunk's truck or camper van or whatever it was, because Barry was good. One of the good guys. A friend. And they took him. Abra went deeper. She didn't bother with what Brad had seen because he hadn't seen anything but a gray rug. He was tied up with tape and lying face down on the floor of whatever Barry the Chunk was driving. That was okay, though. Now that she was tuned in, she could see wider than him. She could see his glove, a Wilson baseball glove, and Barry the Chunk. Then that part flew away. It might swoop back or it might not. It was night. She could smell manure. There was a factory. Some kind of it's busted factory. There was a whole line of vehicles going there. Some small, most big, a couple of them enormous. The headlights were off in case someone was looking, but there was a three-quarters moon in the sky. Enough light to see by. They went down a potholed and bumpy tar road. They went past a water tower. They went past a shed with a broken roof. They went through a rusty gate that was standing open. They went past a sign. It went by so fast you couldn't read it. Then the factory. A busted factory with busted smokestacks and busted windows. There was another sign, and thanks to the moonlight, this one she could read. No trespassing by order of the Canton County Sheriff's Department. They were going around the back, and when they got there, they were going to hurt Brad, the baseball boy, and go on hurting him until he was dead. Abra didn't want to see that part, so she made everything go backwards. That was a little hard, like opening a jar with a really tight cap, but she could do it. When she got back where she wanted, she let go. Barry the Chunk liked that glove because it reminded him of when he was a little boy. That's why he tried it on. Tried it on and smelled the oil Brad used to keep it from getting stiff and bopped his fist in the pocket a few times. But now things were reeling forward and she forgot about Brad's baseball glove again. Water tower, shed with broken roof, rusty gate, and then the first sign. What did it say? Nope, still too quick, even with the moonlight. She rewound again. Now beads of sweat were standing out on her forehead, and let go. Water tower, shed with broken roof, get ready, here it comes, rusty gate, then the sign. This time she could read it, although she wasn't sure she understood it. Abra grabbed the sheet of notepaper on which she had curlicued all those stupid boy names and turned it over. Quickly, before she forgot, she scrawled down everything she had seen on that sign. Organic Industries and Ethanol Plant Number 4 and Freeman, Iowa and Closed Until Further Notice. Okay, now she knew where they had killed him and where, she was sure, they had buried him, baseball glove and all. What next? If she called the number for missing and exploited children, they would hear a little kid's voice and pay no attention, except maybe to give her telephone number to the police, who would probably have her arrested for trying to prank on people who were already sad and unhappy. She thought of her mother next, but with Momo sick and getting ready to die, it was out of the question. Mom had enough to worry about without this. Abra got up, went to the window, and stared out at her street. At the lickety-split convenience store on the corner, which the older kids called the lickety-spliff because of all the dope that got smoked behind it where the dumpsters were, and the white mountains poking up at a clear blue late summer sky. She had begun to rub her mouth, an anxiety tick her parents were trying to break her of, but they weren't here, so boo on that. Boo all over that. Dad's right downstairs. She didn't want to tell him either. Not because he had to finish his book, but because he wouldn't want to get involved in something like this, even if he believed her. Abra didn't have to read his mind to know that. So who? Before she could think of the logical answer, the world beyond her window began to turn, as if it were mounted on a gigantic disc. A low cry escaped her, and she clutched at the sides of the window, bunching the curtains in her fists. This had happened before, always without warning, and she was terrified each time it did, because it was like having a seizure. She was no longer in her own body,
She was far being instead of far seeing, and what if she couldn't get back? The turntable slowed, then stopped. Now, instead of being in her bedroom, she was in a supermarket. She knew because ahead of her was the meat counter. Over it, the sign, easy to read thanks to bright fluorescence, was a promise. At Sam's, every cut is a blue ribbon cowboy cut. For a moment or two, the meat counter drew closer because the turntable had slid her into someone who was walking. Walking and shopping. Barry the Chunk. No, not him, although Barry was near. Barry was how she had gotten here. Only she had been drawn away from him by someone much more powerful. Abra could see a cart loaded with groceries at the bottom of her vision. Then the forward movement stopped, and there was this sensation, this rummaging, prying, crazy feeling of someone inside her. And Abra suddenly understood that for once she wasn't alone on the turntable. She was looking toward a meat counter at the end of a supermarket aisle, and the other person was looking out her window at Richland Court and the White Mountains beyond. Panic exploded inside her. It was as if gasoline had been poured on a fire. Not a sound escaped her lips, which were pressed together so tightly that her mouth was only a stitch, but inside her head she produced a scream louder than anything of which she would ever have believed herself capable. No! Get out of my head! 8. When David felt the house rumble and saw the overhead light fixture in his study swaying on its chain, his first thought was, Abra, that his daughter had had one of her psychic outbursts, though there hadn't been any of that telekinetic crap in years and never anything like this. As things settled back to normal, his second, and to his mind far more reasonable, thought was that he had just experienced his first New Hampshire earthquake. He knew they happened from time to time, but wow! He got up from his desk, not neglecting to hit save before he did, and ran into the hall. From the foot of the stairs he called, Abra, did you feel that? She came out of her room looking pale and a little scared.
Yeah, sorta. I think
It was an earthquake, David told her, beaming. Your first earthquake! Isn't that neat?
Yes, Abra said, not sounding very thrilled. Neat.
He looked out the living room window and saw people standing on their stoops and lawns. His good friend Matt Renfrew was among them. I'm going to go across the street and talk to Matt, hon. You want to come with?
I guess I better finish my math.
David started toward the front door, then turned to look up at her. You're not scared, are you? You don't have to be. It's over.
Abra only wished it was. 9. Rose the Hat was doing a double shop because Grandpa Flick was feeling poorly again. She saw a few other members of the True and Sam's and nodded to them. She stopped a while in canned goods to talk to Barry the Chink, who had his wife's list in one hand. Barry was concerned about Flick. He'll bounce back, Rose said. You know Grandpa.
Barry grinned. Tougher'n a boiled owl. Rose nodded and got her cart rolling again.
You bet he is.
Just an ordinary weekday afternoon at the supermarket, and as she took her leave of Barry, she at first mistook what was happening to her for something mundane, maybe low sugar. She was prone to sugar crashes and usually kept a candy bar in her purse. Then she realized someone was inside her head. Someone was looking. Rose had not risen to her position as head of the True Knot by being indecisive. She halted with her cart pointed toward the meat counter, her planned next stop, and immediately leaped into the conduit some nosy and potentially dangerous person had established. Not a member of the True, she would have known any one of them immediately, but not an ordinary rube either. No. This was far from ordinary. The market swung away, and suddenly she was looking out at a mountain range. Not the Rockies. She would have recognized those. These were smaller,
The Catskills? The Adirondacks? It could have been either, or some other. As for the looker, Rose thought it was a child, almost certainly a girl, and one she had encountered before. I have to see what she looks like. Then I can find her any time I want to. I have to get her to look in a mirror. But then a thought as loud as a shotgun blast in a closed room.
No! Get out of my head!
Wiped her mind clean and sent her staggering against shelves of canned soups and vegetables. They went cascading to the floor, rolling everywhere. For a moment or two, Rose thought she was going to follow them, swooning like the dewy heroine of a romance novel. Then she was back. The girl had broken the connection, and in rather spectacular fashion. Was her nose bleeding? She wiped it with her fingers and checked. No, good. One of the stock boys came rushing up.
Are you okay, ma'am?
Fine, just felt a little faint for a second or two. Probably from the tooth extraction I had yesterday. It's passed off now. I've made a mess, haven't I? Sorry. Good thing it was cans instead of bottles.
No problem, no problem at all. Would you like to come up front and sit on the taxi bench?
That won't be necessary, Rose said, and it wasn't, but she was done shopping for the day. She rolled her cart two aisles over and left it there.
10. She had brought her Tacoma, old but reliable, down from the high country campground west of Sidewinder, and once she was in the cab, she pulled her phone out of her purse and hit speed dial. It rang at the other end just a single time.
"What's up, Rosie girl?"
crowed Eddie. "We've got a problem." Of course, it was also an opportunity. A kid with enough in her boiler to set off a blast like that, to not only detect Rose but send her reeling, wasn't just a steamhead, but the find of the century. She felt like Captain Ahab for the first time sighting his great white whale.
"Talk to me."
All business now. "A little over 2 years ago, the kid in Iowa. Remember him?"
"Sure."
"You also remember me telling you we had a looker?"
"Yeah. East Coast. You thought it was probably a girl."
"It was a girl, all right. She just found me again. I was in Sam's, minding my own business, and then all at once, there she was."
"Why, after all this time?"
"I don't know, and I don't care, but we have to have her, Crow. We have to have her."
"Does she know who you are? Where we are?"
Rose had thought about this while walking to the truck. The intruder hadn't seen her, of that much she was sure. The kid had been on the inside looking out. As to what she had seen? A supermarket aisle. How many of those were there in America? Probably a million.
"I don't think so, but that's not the important part." "Then what is?"
"Remember me telling you she was big steam? Huge steam? Well, she's even bigger than that. When I tried to turn it around on her, she blew me out of her head, like I was a piece of milkweed fluff. Nothing like that's ever happened to me before. I would have said it was impossible."
"Is she potential true or potential food?"
"I don't know." "But she did. They needed steam, stored steam, a lot more than they needed fresh recruits. Besides, Rose wanted no one in the true with that much power."
"Okay. How do we find her? Any ideas?"
Rose thought of what she'd seen through the girl's eyes before she had been so unceremoniously booted back to Sam's supermarket in Sidewinder. "Not much, but there had been a store." She said, "The kids call it the Lickety Spliff."
"Huh? Nothing. Never mind. I need to think about it. But we're going to have her, Crow.
We've got to have her."
There was a pause. When he spoke again, Crow sounded cautious. "The way you're talking, there might be enough to fill a dozen canisters. If, that is, you really don't want to try turning her."
Rose gave a distracted, yapping laugh.
If I'm right, we don't have enough canisters to store the steam from this one. If she was a mountain, she'd be Everest.
He made no reply. Rose didn't need to see him or poke into his mind to know he was flabbergasted.
Maybe we don't have to do either one.
I don't follow.
Of course he didn't.
Long think had never been Crow's specialty.
Maybe we don't have to turn her or kill her. Think cows.
Cows.
You can butcher one and get a couple of months' worth of steaks and hamburgers. But if you keep it alive and take care of it, it will give milk for 6 years, maybe even 8. Silence. Long. She let it stretch. When he replied, he sounded more cautious than ever.
I've never heard of anything like that. We kill 'em once we've got the steam, or if they've got something we need and they're strong enough to survive the turn, we turn 'em. The way we turned Andy back in the 80s. Grandpa Flick might say different. If you believe him, he remembers all the way back to when Henry VIII was killing his wives, but I don't think the true has ever tried just holding on to a steamhead. If she's as strong as you say, it could be dangerous.
Tell me something I don't know. If you'd felt what I did, you'd call me crazy to even think about it. And maybe I am. But
she was tired of spending so much of her time, the whole family's time, scrambling for nourishment, of living like 10th-century gypsies when they should have been living like the kings and queens of creation, which was what they were. Talk to Grandpa if he's feeling better, and Heavy Mary, she's been around almost as long as Flick. Snakebite Andy, she's new, but she's got a good head on her shoulders.
Anyone else you think might have valuable input?
Jesus, Rosie, I don't know.
Neither do I, not yet. I'm still reeling. All I'm asking right now is for you to do some spade work. You are the advance man, after all.
Okay.
Oh, and make sure you talk to Walnut. Ask him what drugs might keep a rube child nice and docile for a long period of time.
This girl doesn't sound like much of a rube to me.
Oh, she is. A big, old, fat rube milk cow.
Not exactly true. A great big white whale, that's what she is.
Rose ended the call without waiting to see if Crow Daddy had anything else to say. She was the boss, and as far as she was concerned, the discussion was over.
She's a white whale, and I want her.
But Ahab hadn't wanted his whale just because Moby would provide tons of blubber and almost endless barrels of oil, and Rose didn't want the girl because she might, given the right drug cocktails and a lot of powerful psychic soothing, provide a nearly endless supply of steam.
It was more personal than that. Turn her? Make her part of the true knot? Never.
The kid had kicked Rose the hat out of her head as if she were some annoying religious goofball going door to door and handing out end-of-the-world tracts. No one had ever given her that kind of bum's rush before.
No matter how powerful she was, she had to be taught a lesson. And I'm just the woman for the job.
Rose the Hat started her truck, pulled out of the supermarket parking lot, and headed for the family-owned Bluebell Campground. It was a really beautiful location, and why not? One of the world's great resort hotels had once stood there. But, of course, the overlook had burned to the ground long ago.
11. The Renfrews, Matt and Cassie, were the neighborhood's party people, and they decided on the spur of the moment to have an earthquake barbecue. They invited everyone on Richland Court, and almost everyone came. Matt got a case of soda, a few bottles of cheap wine, and a beer ball from the lickety-split up the street. It was a lot of fun. And David Stone enjoyed himself tremendously. As far as he could tell, Abra did too. She hung with her friends Julie and Emma, and he made sure that she ate a hamburger and some salad. Lucy had told him they had to be vigilant about their daughter's eating habits because she'd reached the age when girls started to be very conscious about their weight and looks, the age at which anorexia or bulimia were apt to show their skinny, starveling faces. What he didn't notice, although Lucy might have had she been there, was that Abra wasn't joining in her friend's apparently non-stop giggle fest. And after eating a bowl of ice cream, a small bowl, she asked her father if she could go back across the street and finish her homework.
Okay, David said, but thank Mr. and Mrs. Renfrew first.
This Abra would have done without having to be reminded, but she agreed without saying so.
You're very welcome, Abby, Mrs. Renfrew said. Her eyes were almost preternaturally bright from three glasses of white wine. Isn't this cool? We should have earthquakes more often. Although I was talking to Vicky Fenton, you know the Fentons on Pond Street? That's just a block over, and she said they didn't feel anything. Isn't that weird?
Sure is, Abra agreed, thinking that when it came to weird, Mrs. Renfrew didn't know the half of it. 12. She finished her homework and was downstairs watching TV with her dad when Mom called. Abra talked to her a while, then turned the phone over to her father. Lucy said something, and Abra knew what it had been even before Dave glanced at her and said, "Yeah, she's fine. Just blitzed from homework, I think. They give the kids so much now. Did she tell you we had a little earthquake?"
"Going upstairs, Dad," Abra said, and he gave her an absent wave. She sat at her desk, turned on her computer, then turned it off again.
She didn't want to play Fruit Ninja, and she certainly didn't want to IM with anyone. She had to think about what to do, because she had to do something.
She put her school books in her backpack, then looked up, and the woman from the supermarket was staring in at her from the window. That was impossible because the window was on the second floor, but she was there. Her skin was unblemished and purest white, her cheekbones high, her dark eyes wide set and slightly tilted at the corners. Abra thought she might be the most beautiful woman she had ever seen. Also, she realized at once, and without a shadow of a doubt, she was insane. Masses of black hair framed her perfect, somehow arrogant face and streamed down over her shoulders. Staying in place on this wealth of hair, in spite of the crazy angle at which it was cocked, was a jaunty top hat of scuffed velvet. "She's not really there, and she's not in my head either. I don't know how I can be seeing her, but I am, and I don't think she kn—" The mad woman in the darkening window grinned, and when her lips spread apart, Abra saw she only had one tooth on top, a monstrous, discolored tusk. She understood it had been the last thing Bradley Trevor had ever seen, and she screamed. Screamed as loudly as she could, but only inside, because her throat was locked and her vocal cords were frozen. Abra shut her eyes. When she opened them again, the grinning white-faced woman was gone. Not there, but she could come. She knows about me, and she could come. In that moment, she realized what she should have known as soon as she saw the abandoned factory. There was really only one person she could call on, only one who could help her. She closed her eyes again, this time not to hide from a horrible vision looking in at her from the window, but to summon help.
"Tony! I need your dad! Please, Tony, please!"
Still, with her eyes shut, but now feeling the warmth of tears on her lashes and cheeks, she whispered, "Help me, Tony. I'm scared."
Chapter 8. Abra's Theory of Relativity. 1. The last run of the day on the Helen Rivington was called the Sunset Cruise, and many evenings when Dan wasn't on shift at the hospice, he took the controls. Billy Freeman, who had made the run roughly 25,000 times during his years as a town employee, was delighted to turn them over.
"You never get tired of it, do you?" he asked Dan once.
Put it down to a deprived childhood. It hadn't been, not really, but he and his mother had moved around a lot after the settlement money ran out, and she had worked a lot of jobs. With no college degree, most of them had been low-paying.
She'd kept a roof over their heads and food on the table, but there had never been much extra. Once, he'd been in high school, the two of them living in Bradenton, not far from Tampa, he'd asked her why she never dated. By then, he was old enough to know she was still a very good-looking woman. Wendy Torrance had given him a crooked smile and said, "One man was enough for me, Danny. Besides, now I've got you."
"How much did she know about you drinking?" Casey Kay had asked him during one of their meetings at the Sunspot. "You started pretty young, right?"
Dan had needed to give that one some thought. "Probably more than I knew at the time, but we never talked about it. I think she was afraid to bring it up. Besides, I never got in trouble with the law. Not then, anyway. And I graduated high school with honors." He had smiled grimly at Casey over his coffee cup. "And of course I never beat her up. I suppose that made a difference."
"Never got that train set, either. But the basic tenet AAs lived by was don't drink and things will get better. They did, too. Now he had the biggest little choo-choo a boy could wish for, and Billy was right, it never got old."
He supposed it might in another 10 or 20 years, but even then Dan thought he'd probably still offer to drive the last circuit of the day just to pilot the Riv at sunset out to the turnaround at Cloud Gap.
The view was spectacular, and when the Saco was calm, which it usually was once its spring convulsions had subsided, you could see all the colors twice, once above and once below. Everything was silence at the far end of the Riv's run. It was as if God was holding his breath.
The trips between Labor Day and Columbus Day, when the Riv shut down for the winter, were the best of all. The tourists were gone, and the few riders were locals, many of whom Dan could now call by name. On weeknights like tonight, there were less than a dozen paying customers, which was fine by him. It was fully dark when he eased the Riv back into its dock at Teeny Town Station. He leaned against the side of the first passenger car with his cap, Engineer Dan stitched in red above the bill, tipped back on his head, wishing his handful of riders a very good night. Billy was sitting on a bench, the glowing tip of his cigarette intermittently lighting his face. He had to be nearly 70, but he looked good, had made a complete recovery from his abdominal surgery 2 years before, and said he had no plans to retire.
"What would I do?"
he'd asked on the single occasion Dan had brought the subject up.
"Retire to that death farm where you work? Wait for your pet cat to pay me a visit? Thanks, but no thanks."
When the last two or three riders had ambled on their way, probably in search of dinner, Billy butted his cigarette and joined him.
"I'll put her in the barn, unless you want to do that too."
"No, go right ahead. You've been sitting on your ass long enough. When are you going to give up the smokes, Billy? You know the doctor said they contributed to your little gut problem."
"I've cut down to almost nothing,"
Billy said, but with a telltale downward shift in his gaze. Dan could have found out just how much Billy had cut down. He probably wouldn't even need to touch the guy in order to get that much info, but he didn't. One day in the summer just past, he'd seen a kid wearing a T-shirt with an octagonal road sign printed on it. Instead of "stop," the sign said TMI. When Danny asked him what it meant, the kid had given him a sympathetic smile he probably reserved strictly for gentlemen of a 40-ish persuasion.
"Too much information," he'd said.
Dan thanked him, thinking, "Story of my life, young fellow."
Everyone had secrets. This he had known from earliest childhood. Decent people deserved to keep theirs, and Billy Freeman was decency personified.
"Want to go for a coffee, Dano? You got time? Won't take me 10 minutes to put this bitch to bed."
Dan touched the side of the engine lovingly.
"Sure, but watch your mouth. This is no bitch. This is a lit."
That was when his head exploded.
2. When he came back to himself, he was sprawled on the bench where Billy had been smoking. Billy was sitting beside him, looking worried. Hell, looking scared after death. He had his phone in one hand, with his finger poised over the buttons. "Put it away," Dan said. The words came out in a dusty croak. He cleared his throat and tried again. "I'm okay."
"You sure? Jesus Christ, I thought you was having a stroke. I thought it for sure."
That's what it felt like.
For the first time in years, Dan thought of Dick Halloran, the Overlook Hotel's chef extraordinaire back in the day. Dick had known almost at once that Jack Torrance's little boy shared his own talent. Dan wondered now if Dick might still be alive. Almost certainly not. He'd been pushing 60 back then.
"Who's Tony?" Billy asked.
"Huh?"
"You said, 'Please, Tony, please.' Who's Tony?"
"A guy I used to know back in my drinking days." As an improvisation, it wasn't much, but it was the first thing to come into his still dazed mind. "A good friend." Billy looked at the lighted rectangle of his cell a few seconds longer, then slowly folded the phone and put it away.
"You know, I don't believe that for a minute. I think you had one of your flashes. Like on the day you found out about my..."
He tapped his stomach. "Well..." Billy raised a hand.
"Say no more, as long as you're okay, that is. And as long as it isn't something bad about me, because I'd want to know if it was. I don't suppose that's true of everyone, but it is with me."
"Nothing about you." Dan stood up and was pleased to discover his legs held him just fine. "But I'm going to take a rain check on that coffee, if you don't mind."
"Not a bit. You need to go back to your place and lie down. You're still pale. Whatever it was, it hit you hard."
Billy glanced at the riv.
"Glad it didn't happen while you were up there in the peak seat rolling along at 40.
"Tell me about it," Dan said.
3. He crossed Cranmore Avenue to the Rivington House side, meaning to take Billy's advice and lie down, but instead of turning in at the gate giving on the big old Victorian's flower-bordered walk, he decided to stroll a little while. He was getting his wind back now, getting himself back, and the night air was sweet. Besides, he needed to consider what had just happened, and very carefully. "Whatever it was, it hit you hard." That made him think again of Dick Halloran, and of all the things he had never told Casey Kingsley. Nor would he. The harm he had done to Deanie, and to her son, he supposed, simply by doing nothing, was lodged deep inside, like an impacted wisdom tooth, and there it would stay. But at 5, Danny Torrance had been the one harmed, along with his mother, of course, and his father had not been the only culprit. About that, Dick had done something. If not, Dan and his mother would have died in the Overlook. Those old things were still painful to think about, still bright with the childish primary colors of fear and horror. He would have preferred never to think of them again, but now he had to, because, well, because everything that goes around comes around. Maybe it's luck, or maybe it's fate, but either way, it comes back around. What was it Dick said that day he gave me the lockbox? "When the pupil is ready, the teacher will appear." Not that I'm equipped to teach anyone anything, except maybe that if you don't take a drink, you won't get drunk. He'd reached the end of the block. Now he turned around and headed back. He had the sidewalk entirely to himself. It was eerie how fast Frasier emptied out once the summer was over, and that made him think of the way the Overlook had emptied out, how quickly the little Torrance family had had the place entirely to themselves. Except for the ghosts, of course. They never left.
4.
Halloran had told Danny he was headed to Denver and from there he'd fly south to Florida. He had asked if Danny would like to help him down to the Overlook's parking lot with his bags, and Danny had carried one to the cook's rental car. Just a little thing, hardly more than a briefcase, but he'd needed to use both hands to tote it. When the bags were safely stowed in the trunk and they were sitting in the car, Halloran had put a name to the thing in Danny Torrance's head, the thing his parents only half believed in.
"You got a knack. Me, I've always called it the shining. That's what my grandmother called it, too. Get you kind of lonely, thinking you were the only one?" Yes, he had been lonely, and yes, he had believed he was the only one. Halloran had disabused him of that notion.
In the years since, Dan had run across a lot of people who had, in the cook's words,